7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. Oh, good afternoon, out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 and or 92.3 FM, also streaming from KYRS. And it's going to be, you know, the show. We've had a lot of hurt go on in our community this last, since Saturday. A lot of people have lost their homes. Luckily, so far, we don't know of any loss of life in our community, but it certainly has been a sad time, and a time where maybe we've seen the best of human behavior, exemplified by neighbors, reaching out to neighbors, our firefighters, which I'm so happy to have been a part of that community. And you have really good people out there doing the job that I used to work with, and I'm really proud of them. And then we also have people who take advantage of people, or maybe stoking conspiracy theories and other crazy stuff. So it's kind of a mixed bag of a day. But you know what? We're going to acknowledge what has happened, but we are also going to move on because, you know, I think sometimes it's good to touch base with some good things. And I have an artist with me who I've been diligently looking at her work for a while because I'm really excited about this show that she's going to do. I have Jennifer Saw with me. Hello, Jennifer. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my gosh. It is so good to have you. And your work, you open up this Friday at the Terrain Gallery, correct?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Is everything all loaded up for your...
Yes, I finished install yesterday, and yeah, it's all up and ready. And
you have so much experience, I suppose. Do you like to be the person overlooking the installation, or do you like to just see, I'm going to let somebody else do this?
I've luckily been able to show my work often, but not have been able to always install it myself because I'm sending my work off to other places in the country.
Right.
And so I send like 27 page documents of how to install.
If I just say at that point, like, why don't we just buy her a ticket?
Right. So this time it was great to be in there and handle the work myself and really walk through the space and look at it from the same, like, you know, and sort of think of placement and where your body is in the space and do it myself. So, yes, to answer your question, I think I am very prone and keen to really sort of managing.
Well, it's your baby,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And your show, and I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly to make sure that it is. So give me a chance here. Bob Garut?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, Bob Garut. Number one, rice bowl. Number two, means of living.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So that's a dictionary sort of pull, right? I oriented it to look like a dictionary. I do a lot of Googling the Korean language.
Yeah.
Not that because I'm not fluent. I just find that the chunkiness of translating through something else and somebody else really interesting.
Yeah.
And so the title comes from that me finding that interesting, and also the word literally is describing a bowl of rice, and it is also a kind of metaphor for work.
Is the etymology of that behind because you work to get a bowl of rice, or how does that?
Yeah, I think so. It's like the labor and the thing that you do as your career is the thing that provides you the daily bowl of rice.
Uh-huh.
And so your work is your bowl of rice.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I think that's really interesting about the, you know, you looking up the definitions. Do you find that, does your artwork mean different things to, say, different communities? Do you, if you have Korean Americans looking at it Do they come away with something a little bit different, do you think, than other populations?
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I think, so first and foremost, the works are about drawings and about sculpture, right? And mm-hmm. about observing and like not, and like the flatness and the sort of, the illusion of depth and the reiteration of flat. Anyway, yeah. all that nerdy stuff about drawing as like an academic thing. So first and foremost, it's about that. And hopefully the majority of the public gets to have fun looking at objects that are recognizable and that are made in an interesting sort of way. And craft is fun to look at. But then the selection of the types of objects and the selection of like how the titles are translated, how it's described, that I think is a little bit more narrow to my experience and perspective, so, sure. which is Korean-American. And so if you are Korean-American, I think you would connect to that slightly more cultural niche.
And, yes. and you not only Korean-American, but you also have lived all over the country. And that's an experience that I've had as well, ever since I was a child, yeah. moving all over the place. So you pick up those cultures as well.
You really did look me up.
I did look you up. I wasn't not borderline stalking, but it's my job. Okay. So, but so you lived in Florida, yes. but also spent time in Los Angeles, but also you somewhere in the middle there, you were other places too, right?
Yes. Yes. I think I did the math one time and I knew the number off. And it was like a ridiculous number of like 13 cities and yeah. so many states and so many countries in a span of however many years. But yes, I was born in Florida and then quickly moved to California. And then we bounced around a bunch of places. Like we were in Tacoma when I was like 4 to 6, maybe. Then we went back to Florida. We were in Georgia wow. and then we were in Texas. And then, out of all of that growing up, I think there was a good span of 5 years in LA, and that was the largest chunk that I spent somewhere. So that's why I say I grew up in LA, because mm-hmm. that was, again, 5 years was the largest span of it, yeah.
Yeah, I had the same experience, but in San Jose. Mm-hmm. I lived in San Jose from fourth grade until 10th grade.
Oh, well,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
that's the 6 years where I've lived the longest.
Right.
Until I, you know, became an adult. Mm-hmm. But you, sometimes when people move around a lot, they tend to like want to be settled. But it sounds like you were still really a seeker, right? I mean, you travel around. What compels you to travel? I mean, to go to other places and experience things?
Well, to be frank about it, I think until I was an adult, you know, you don't really have the decisions.
Right.
You know, you go where your parents are going, and they were going because they were finding work.
Yes.
And seeking community and whatnot. And as an adult, I made my decisions to move with my husband also because we were finding work.
Right. Right?
Very different type of work in different settings. And thankfully, we had more, I would say, a variety of choices to make. And so it felt more like choices for
right.
for us. And for my parents, it felt like decisions that they just had to make.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the driving force is finding work.
But you, right? but yeah.
Find a means of living.
Right. And your husband's an artist as well, is that
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes.
So, so that's a tall order for you both to be able to find work. And
right.
are you a professor at Gonzaga as well?
Did yes, I yes.
Yeah, okay.
I am currently teaching at Gonzaga in the art department. My husband is currently teaching at Eastern Washington.
Oh, good for you guys. That's awesome. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your pieces because I found them very compelling. At least from the pictures, which I think when I see them for real, it'll be even better. But, you know, I think when I think of like paper sculpture, because I do a lot of paper mache, that's what I go to is paper mache. But yours are really very almost architectural to me, that very delicate, but at the same time, so well thought out that there's like a real strength to them, like a good kite, you know, that's what, yeah. that's what it strikes me with. And, how did you go down that road of making pieces like that?
Oh, that's a great question. And I love that description. Thank you for a good kite. Yeah. yeah. A good strength to it. I mean, I can tell a really long story.
Oh, well, we got plenty of time, so don't worry about it.
I think we can briefly go back to undergrad where, you know, you're excited and making stuff and you're just producing. And I was always drawn to paper, right? So I made things in paper. And back then it was 20-foot drawings that got folded into 5x4 by like 2 feet deep things that hung on the wall. It was really impractical.
Uh-huh. It sounds cool.
It was cool. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
But you know, once you graduate, you don't have the storage space anymore and you don't have the 20-foot wall. And then not only the practicalness was a problem, I didn't know why I liked paper, right? So I didn't know how to think about the decisions that I was making. And your question to how do I get to how I'm making now was a lot of like existential crisis moments of like, why the heck do I do what I do and why must it look like this? And oftentimes if you can't answer that, then you kind of can't, I don't know. I'm the type of person that couldn't continue. It felt like just an exercise to waste time and materials.
Not a rational thing, and you wanted to be rational.
Right, which is also impractical to be really like rational logistic about art, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot of that, and I had a bunch of crisis moments, and I went back to grad school, and it continued, right? Because in grad school, people are throwing 100 things at you, and you have to like, you feel like you have to cater to all of the professor's opinions. And so you make crazy things. At one point I had a dead raw squid in my studio and it was stinky. And then after a while there's things that keep staying behind that you keep gravitating towards. And that was always paper and paper, right? The tendency is to strengthen it with something.
Yeah.
Right. And so glue, right. Paper mache and making it rigid. And I did that too, but then it felt like it was going against the thing that it was. And I was most interested in the fact that this was a thing that can be so easily discarded, but yet how you treat it and how you treat its fragility becomes its preciousness and its longevity. Right,
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I was like, how do I transform this and keep it fragile, but something that is worth feeling like I want to preserve? And so then I was trying a bunch of different things. At the time, I was really into a couple of artists, one named Agnes Martin. She does a bunch of grids. And this idea of like the most boring thing is a grid, right? And she did that for years and days. But then you actually stand in front of one of these grid paintings and it's mesmerizing and it's marvelous. And so that was interesting. It's like utterly dry thing becomes really like encaptivating. And then I also was really interested in an artist named, Via Selmans. She makes lovely drawings that are really photorealistic, but then you zoom in and they're very much drawings. She doesn't hide the pencil marks.
Okay.
And so then this idea of like drawing that reinstates itself as a drawing, and then this like idea of a grid that's completely boring, and then how do I make these two things my own? And I sort of fell into I was thinking back to like, what other things have I seen that was interesting to me that sort of stuck out in my memory? And I remember another artist that was brought in when I was in undergrad as a guest speaker, and he described one of his paintings that he did And his thought process of that was, how do I make the most non-political but connectable thing? And it was this giant drawing of a hand holding just a bowl, right? Uh-huh. And it was at such an angle you couldn't see inside of it, so you couldn't see if it was full or empty.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, cool, yeah, a bowl is a thing that is really universal and also really narrow and personal, right?
Yeah.
It's such an everybody's everyday item, but it's also per culture, per area, per region, very specific to the material it's made out of, how it's used, what it looks like, what it's ornamented with. And then I was like, well, what is my bowl? And it's the little tiny rice bowl. And I tried to make a rice bowl out of paper. And that's the first iteration of this body of work that happened in 2020. That was a long walk.
Wow. No, that's, you brought me along really beautifully in that. When I look at these pieces and when you talk about the fragility of them, there is something compelling that you want to pick them up. You know, I mean, yeah. And just see, like, do they weigh like nothing? I mean, they seem so, I wouldn't say aerodynamic, but really, I love that the grid paper thing really does, now that makes a lot of sense to me when I look at those. Futuristic, but at the same time, maybe in a future that is a little bit dystopic, maybe? I don't know. Is that something that's, am I seeing that right? I mean, they're clean lines, but it almost seems like if 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, had maybe hell, you know, get a little paper architecture. I don't know.
So like three thoughts come to mind about the griddedness of it. And one is going back to that, at the beginning, I was talking about how this is about as much about drawing as it is about anything else. I was always drawn to paper, but I was also drawn to the process of drawing. And because that it's such an immediate thing, right? Mm-hmm. There's no hours of mixing paint and matching color, priming something. You take the implement and you draw, and there's a mark, and it records that moment and that movement and that, like, that gesture and however pressure, like, all of that is recorded very I think poetically in a drawing. And so, but then also drawing is always about trying to be illusionistic, mm-hmm. especially at the very beginning when we're learning
perspective and all that.
It's all about on this flat thing you have to pretend and like create this dimensional thing, but the more you make it dimensional illusionistically, the more you, I think, reiterate that this is a flat piece of paper, right? Mm-hmm. And that you lift it and there's nothing. So then
almost like a cheap magic trick,
right? And I liked that idea, but I wanted it to be done in a different way. And so it's basically doing that in like reverse order, where I look at the object and I try to imagine the bowl in its form flat, right? Like splayed out.
Yeah.
And if the sides has a circumference of however many inches, then it would be this a line that's like 8 inches. And then if I turn that into like the curvature, if it's a really chunky curve, then like the sides are a half an inch wide and I have these many panels or of half an inch little trapezoid shapes. Anyway, so like I imagine that. And then once I draw the bowl flat, then it rebuilds into a dimensional thing. And that's thought one, right? The second thought is this idea of like three-dimensional planar is now so much of a digital space. Like I didn't really think about this portion until I did a brief residency back in 2023. 3 summer, and somebody was like, yeah, I saw your thing and it looked like one of those little CAD drawings. And everyone asks if any of it is done in any way digitally, and it's all completely sort of maniacally, manually measured, right?
Yeah, good.
And so, but then, which is interesting, like even students these days, you tell them, you say the word 3D design or 3D whatever, and we're describing sculpture in like physical form, and they immediately go to this digital flat space that is a kind of inverted three dimension, right? It exists three dimensionally, but it's also a non-tangible space. I think that's interesting that this fragile thing, in this day and age kind of mimics that visual. This is a new thought for me, so I'm not 100% where to go with that, but that's starting to creep in, and I'm trying to see if I can, I don't know if I'll do anything with it. And then the third thought, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm jumping around.
No, you're laying out really well for me. Thank you.
The way I construct these is first I draw them, right? And it's always color pencil. And I sharpen it occasionally. So as I draw the lines, it's pretty sharp, and then it like crumbles and the lines get really fat. Even though I am maniacally measuring things to be accurate, I let the mark making kind of deteriorate.
Yeah.
And then in order to construct these, I have to re-measure to score them to be accurate, right? And then so then I have to like measure through deteriorating lines. And so they ever so slightly get a little skewed. And as I'm folding and gluing and cutting, I have to like re-measure 3 or 4 times again the same space. But each time the bowl gets, or like the idea of the initial bowl gets slightly more removed and different. So those are the thoughts on the gridness of the pieces.
Well, and that's the beauty of art, right? I mean, as a painter, so many times I sit down to do something.
Yeah.
But then the painting says, no, we're not doing that. Or is writing, you know, we're not, the characters say, we're not doing that. You know, and so I can just see, I think that's just lovely. I can picture you with your pencils and doing that. Well, I have so many questions, but our conversation so far has spurred different questions.
Okay.
And I'm going to, we have to do my 20-minute after the hour business. And while I load things up on the computer, I'm going to play a little music. And then we are going to be right back. But before we do, we should let people know, before we do that, we should let people know how they can come and see your show.
Oh, it's at Terrain Gallery off of Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
It's our first Friday is happening this Friday on the 7th. I don't know what the time is.
I'm not sure either, but it's in the evening, and people are walking around for First Friday. So that's and look online for the Terrain Gallery, because it's kind of, you know, the hours after Friday. I think it's like Friday, Saturday, maybe Sunday, but then some days during the week they're closed.
First Friday, 5 p.m.
Okay, 5 p.m. And so Friday, 5 p.m., Terrain Gallery.
Yes.
Is there a way that people can look at your art, just like a website or anything like that?
Yes, jennifersaw.com, JennifersSeo.com is my website. And hasn't been updated in a couple of years, but there's stuff on there.
That's because you're an artist. All right. Okay, we're going to play some music, and then we'll be right back.
Out and About receives support from Eastern Washington University, the region's polytechnic, offering an increased emphasis on real-world, hands-on learning to build career-ready skills and a lifelong community. More information at ewu.edu.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for August 3rd through the 6th. Monday, Jenny and the Weasels at Zola, Nick Shoulders and Randy Arman at the District, and the Mac Movement open mic with Raw B at the Red Room. Monday and Tuesday, open jam at Jackson Street. Tuesday, Rogan Tinsley at 1919 Wine Cellar, open mic with Nate Dunnigan at the Parlor, and Jameson Sampson and the All-Star Jam at Zola. Wednesday, the River Street Latin Band, Hannah Siglin and others at the Kendall Yards Night Market, Justin Priest on the Montvale Rooftop, Liam St. John and Davis Corley at the District, Aki Fumikado and John Roberts y Pan Blanco at Zola, and the Downtown Get Down Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, Hannah Boundy at Rocky Hill Park in Liberty Lake, Blues Jam at Chan's Red Dragon, Legend Zeppelin at the Big Dipper, Inland Beaches and Gloria at Zola, Light on Water at Coeur d'Alene Park and Brown's Edition, and the Groovy Smoothies at Brick West. For an entire hour of local musicians, tune into Sounds of Spokane every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
The Spokane Regional Health District reminds caregivers that life jackets float, kids don't. Information about water safety can be found online at srhd.org/prevent-drowning.
Okay, we are back on the air. You're listening, of course, to Out and About. I'm your host, Maeve, and I'm talking to Jennifer Sow, whose show, Bop Garut, is showing at the Terrain Gallery starting this Friday for First Friday. You know, you can go walk around downtown, walk up to the Monroe Street Gallery and check that out. And we're talking about, it's mostly, is it all, it's all paper, right? Everything is paper?
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, so, you know, you talked about always being kind of interested in paper and like what you can do with it. And of course, a Japanese culture, you're Korean, but Korean American, but Japanese culture has origami. Yes. Is there something similar in Korean culture to origami or?
Good question. With paper, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, we have that mulberry paper. We're very proud of having made.
Right. Is that what you use a lot of times?
No, I don't actually.
Yeah. That'd be nice.
I know it would be nice, but the fiber of it doesn't, and it's not as honestly as translucent.
Yeah. It's, yours looks like rice paper to me. Yeah. Is it rice paper? Or?
It's any translucent paper that I can get my hands on. Okay. Mostly right now, a kind of vellum.
Okay, vellum. Yeah. Okay.
Very cool. A smooth surfaced vellum is what I'm using lately. But yeah, other than that, I don't, they made their doors out of paper. I mean, but a lot of East Asian cultures did.
Yeah.
What else did we have? I think there's a kind of paper flower decorative thing, but I don't know how traditional that actually is. But,
were your parents artistic at all? Were they artists or?
I think my mom really wanted to be, and then she had to make career choices that were more, you know, just got her food on the table.
Yeah.
So, not really.
Yeah. Because you know that is almost like a stereotype with. Asian American women and their parents are like, you have to be a doctor or you have to be, you know, why are you wasting your, I think it's Jennifer Cho, you know, like, why are you being a comedian? Why are you doing these things? You know?
Absolutely.
And, but, you know, so sometimes they'll go off, they'll become doctors and then go do what they want to do at all. Did you have any kind of pressure like that at all growing up?
Yes, definitely. So I say mom had to do something that got her bread, but she ended up becoming a fashion designer. She made clothes, not on a huge level, you know, but like small production and manufacturing she did in LA for a little while. So she still was very like parallel to wanting to be, I mean, I think that's still a creative profession.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just not as like theoretic. Goal is just whatever vast spectrum of fine arts, right?
Yeah.
But so like she wanted me to not have that until she got to that job in her life in LA. That was the stable point of her life, right? Before that, it was like cleaning, and they would like scrub apartments after people move out. They did like delivery trucks, and you know, way back when like that didn't exist, so it was like an Astro van and and stuff in the back without anyway. So I think she was always. Yes, there was a huge amount of expectation on my part to not go into a field that was what she thought unsure.
Yeah.
But I honestly think even the sciences and the more, yeah, they're still as unstable and volatile.
And they're getting less stable too, right?
Right.
I mean, oh, why don't you be an accountant? Well, that's probably going to go away. You know, I mean, all that stuff.
It's, yeah.
How has your relationship, this is a weird question, mm-hmm. I apologize, but has your relationship with paper changed over the years?
That's a good question.
Thank you. I wasn't sure.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess I could describe more about like why do I stick with it, right?
Yeah.
Because in undergrad, it was just this like, just an interest blindly. Like I liked it, and that was my reason. I didn't really know why. I just liked it, and there was no parallel for it, like no real like reasoning that sort of, anyway, I don't know how to describe this. But so in continuing to make the work and trying to find out what it is, and in 2020 I made that first bowl, right? And from there I kept making objects, and I made objects that I thought looked interesting, and that were familiar to me, but also about like handleable things, right? I had that idea. Continuing from the bowl, like this thing that was really fragile, that was inviting touch, but you felt like you couldn't touch, like that was an interesting idea. And so I kept making things like that. And then I got kind of scared of the formula of it, right?
Uh-huh.
Like and I don't think that's always a bad thing to have a kind of formula and rule, but at the beginning, not knowing what the formula was about, just having a formula.
And that would shut off any kind of the creative flow.
Right. And so, and then I felt like I was doing the thing to do the thing. And then I found a stack of old family photographs of family that are immediate and extended family that are still in Korea, as well as some that have moved and immigrated to Canada and the United States and elsewhere. And I thought this is an interesting thing of records, right? Where, and there was a bunch of thought behind that, but I decided to use that photograph. And I think there was one specifically that sort of really changed the way I think about paper. And the reason why I was interested in it, there was one where I recognized my mom and she was very young. And I knew that the baby that it was a picture of my mom holding a baby, and there's some orchid plants behind her. And it's in a room that I recognized as my grandparents' house from way back when. But then like everything else was really unfamiliar. Hmm. But I initially was interested in the orchid plant behind the people, right? Because of the orchid plant being this very kind of cliche thing you see in old dramas where someone's like wiping it and, and it's this thing in a very specific little tall vase.
And there's something kind of sexual about an orchid, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, and then there's that like ink painting that, I think when you're learning to hold the brush and do the calligraphy, it's like one of the first things you learn to do is this, it's called nanchigi, which you draw a couple of things, and then you put a couple orchids on it. So I was going through all of that in my head, and I was like, oh, cool, I have a family photograph with this thing that is so vaguely related historically and traditionally. I'll make the plant. But before I made the plant, I thought, why don't I feel like I need the reference of the plant also to like tie in with why I made the plant, yeah. Right? So I made the photo into a sculptural object, and I also made an orchid plant to reference that in this. And I was pretty proud of it, right? And I showed my mom the thing that I did, and she was like, uh-uh, don't have me visible in your artwork. What are you doing? Oh, no. You didn't ask my permission to have my face.
You didn't get her to sign a release form first.
Huh? I haven't even shown this work, right? You don't even know if this is going anywhere. But she was so uncomfortable by being made visible.
Yeah.
And I thought that wasn't like, not that I didn't know about this, but right, because all of the growing up as a second generation, meaning I was born here and my parents being immigrated here,
right?
They're always so scared about standing out too much,
right?
Right, but then you don't ever want to like disappear. So there's this really weird like tightrope walk about being just enough visible that you're like catering and safe,
yeah,
but you're not too visible that you're too other, right? And too assertive about who you are. And the direction you get from your parents, I'm sure this generation, the younger generation now, is very different because things are cool now. Yeah. Korean things are cool now.
Right.
But when I was growing up, it was like, no, you don't talk about the food you eat. You don't, you know, you make sure you look at what other kids are wearing and you try to wear what they're wearing.
Yeah.
It's pretty big. And like you try to figure out what they're watching, and you don't talk about the stacks of rented videos that are Korean dramas in your house, right?
Yeah.
And so like I knew this kind of existed, but then when I'm grown up and she's much older and things are like cool now, and it's still, she's so anxious about being made visible.
Yeah.
It was quite shocking, and we had many conversations again about it. And then ultimately I ended up carving her out of the work, and now there's a person shaped hole in the photograph.
Oh, wow. That really emphasizes her more than in a way, doesn't it? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, and it almost feels kind of violently removed. Aggressive,
that.
Not violent. Violence, yeah. A wrong word, but yeah. Like aggressively removed. And she was okay with that, right? Being removed. But it made for the photograph to be a more interesting object. But also then it made the missingness of the silhouette much more apparent. And then about the non-looking, right?
Yeah.
And the anonymity of this person. And so then it kind of like made sense. Why am I don't think I was channeling the insecurity, but like the idea of paper being so fragile, this thing that I'm always interested in, like a ghostly, shadowy kind of visuals, right?
Yeah.
That is just my proclivity, honestly, but now I have a kind of driving like core nugget of thought process that the work is also about, right?
Yeah.
I'm, you know, the shadowiness and the ghostliness is beautiful and poetic on its own, but it's beautiful and poetic also because I think I am prone to it thinking of mom.
Right.
When I make these works and thinking about her being this nervous.
How is your mom now with your work? Does she go to your gallery shows or?
She's still in Texas, so she will look at a lot of photos and she loves them, and she's always ooing and aahing and about anything else that's, you know, doesn't have her in it.
You know, it's funny how our parents kind of inform our work in weird ways. You know, when I was a kid, I think seventh or eighth grade, I was in Little Abner. And I didn't tell my parents about being in the play. I just went to rehearsals. And then, I guess on the weekend of opening weekend, I said to my mom, hey, if you want to see a show for a minute at the school. So my mom came, and she said to me a few years ago, she said, you know, there I was sitting in the audience, and the curtains opened up, and you were on stage by yourself, and you just started singing. And I felt like I just wanted to sink in my chair and disappear.
Oh, no.
I think about, like, that has informed my work lots of times, because I really think that was a funny reaction.
Right.
You know, but so, you know, it's like, it's funny how our parents do inform them in kind of weird ways, you know, I think. You know, it's funny because when I was looking at your bowl and the spoon that's with it, it's so lovely. It's just so cool and just so, like you said it best, you want to touch it, but you know you shouldn't touch it. have you been following like these, and I think they're all because we've got computers that can figure this stuff out now, like these kayaks that unfold, like they're like a piece of plastic and they weigh like 15 pounds. And you can fold them up, and they make a kayak that you can, like, paddle around in.
Whoa.
And there's something about that that I just thought, it just came to mind when I saw your stuff. And so I think that I love that you do everything by hand, and there's no CAD involved in it. I just think that's so, were you tempted at all to, like, go with the CAD stuff? Or
I don't know anything about it. So I was not. And I think I like the absurdity of it being very manually measured. Right? I think that's an important part of the work. This really ultra dryness that's not supposed to be very serious.
Right.
Have
you ever done work where you've had people watch you do the work of making these?
No, I haven't. I mean, that could be interesting.
That would be interesting. I don't know. Yeah, this is, you know, in part of your reading your statement about your work was that it's kind of like using you know, the beauty of ordinary things that we just sort of take for granted. Do you feel like there's a spirit in things, like the things that we use, the, you know, the homes that we live in? Do you feel like there's like a spirit to those things?
I think there is that's a good question. So that's really interesting, because Korea now is a very Christian country, but ultimately, historically, traditionally, it was a shamanistic thing, and then it was like lightly Buddhist for a little while. Then now it's very Christian with other stuff. But that the shamanistic idea is like everything does have a kind of spirit and ghost and protectorate. But rather, I think if there's a pen or a bowl that we hold dear, right, and we like use every day, rather than it having a spirit, it's almost like we, like, by my touch and by me considering it important, you give it this spirit is a stronger
maybe
word
like
than
an
I've,
energy or
yeah, yeah and not so much as like, I mean, it's almost, it's like an, like, psychological and emotional more than anything, that you give it the power to be precious to you.
Like a transubstantiation of it. Yeah,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it represents something else. My wife will ask me when we're on a vacation sometimes, I'll look at the Ring camera just to look at the house.
Yeah.
And she'll say, why do you do that? Are you worried? And I'm like, I just feel bad for our house because nobody's there right now. She's like, you're so weird, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm like, I don't know. I just feel like it feels sad because we're not there, you know? And maybe, and I was going to say, you know, as human beings, we are like, I think we're always looking for meaning in things and story making, and maybe that's part of it too. I don't know.
Definitely. I think we're always looking for to like connect with something to project onto something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's your practice like for art?
Okay. So little sketchbooks that, cause right now I am a new mom to a 19-month-old. And so adjusting to that.
Congratulations.
So my practice is currently jotting down in sketchbooks. And, you know, whenever there are ideas and thoughts and there's a lot of that. There's also a lot of, I am blessed that my husband also makes work and that he, there are I think, similar veins of thinking that we have and then very different veins of perspective and thinking that we have. And so my husband and I will always have just like riveting conversations about ideas. And sometimes we're just completely disagreeing with each other or agreeing to disagree or agreeing. Right. Or it turns out we're saying the same thing with very different words after like an hour discussion. So the practice starts with that, with a lot of jotting things down and like internally thinking about things and then talking it out with a fellow sharp mind, right? And then going back to the notebooks and honestly Googling a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if I've said this throughout, but the choices early on to make these works and to like gravitate towards the family photos and to make work about now just the experience of my parents and my immediate immigrated family and myself is to like connect to something, right? And what are we rooted in when we are uprooted and rerooted here, and how like for it's a different experience for me as it is for my parents, and then my brother, you know, completely different because he feels, even though we're the same sort of air quote generation, he feels even more removed.
Yeah,
right.
Is he involved in art as well?
No, he did the Korean thing. He did the Asian thing. He's a pre-med. He's in medical school. So, yeah.
your husband, is his medium? Is it? Are you able to like ever do like conceive of any future projects together?
Together, maybe. He does a lot of drawing and painting, and some digital stuff. We've talked about it, but then I think the content, right? The thing that we make and draw of ultimately becomes very different, even though we have similar like lines of thought.
Yeah.
It would be lovely too. We have many ideas in our stacks of notebooks.
Has there been any reactions from people looking at your work that have really surprised you or made you kind of reassess or maybe take your work in a different direction?
I think so. The work is very quiet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in quiet, it's often taken heavily, right? And so I try to always make it a little bit whimsical in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
I try to add a kind of understated humor into things. And if you get it, you get it. That's fine. But even though I know that it's not supposed to be taken so gravely, I am nervous that it is quiet work, right? So when I'm sending it off to shows for a long time, I say long time, but for the past like year or two, I've been creating these kind of elaborate containers for it that become little riser pedestals for the work. So each work has a little box that it sits in as it ships, and then it becomes a thing that it sits on. And that idea of that, like another like absurd way of transporting and extra protectiveness was fun. But then it almost, like I was so scared that the work was too quiet that I made these boxes really present.
Okay.
Right? And these are like dark colors and they're made out of cloth and they're, you know, they're very there.
Yeah.
And it does, in photographs, I think, offset the contrast of these really ghostly things well. But when you're seeing the work displayed, I think it kind of eats up the quietness, right? And so I didn't really realize that because I kept sending the work with these risers until the very last show I had at Buckham Gallery, and the curator was telling me, hey, you have these risers. Do we have to, maybe next time, maybe if they were like lighter value cloth. And I was like, that's a great critique. Thank you. You can totally not display them with them. And I left it up to her curation, and I think she ended up putting them on the risers anyway. But that was the latest critique that I am, I'm grateful for,
because
it doesn't happen as often anymore, right? Outside of being out of grace.
But I like that thing about humor, because that's almost a humorous thing to do, to make something that's, big and bold, but the piece is so delicate.
Right.
I just think that would be, that's pretty cool, actually. Do you ever... So you talk about the quietness of the pieces. Is there music that you like to listen to when you work, or do you or like silence?
That's a great question. So, because that's always, I think, a good studio process question. What do you have in the background? And I cannot listen to music, but I always listen to some sort of audiobook or a lecture of some sort. It has to be like thought.
Yeah.
So then I'm not too lost in my thought with the work, right? If it was music and it's so emotional that I get way into the emotion of the thing and I almost can't concentrate on the work. Does that make sense?
Because
this the way that I make the work is so very repetitive and mundane in how I measure and remeasure and make the same lines over and over again. And I draw the same shape like 18 different times. And then I have to score that same shape as many times.
Yeah.
I have to cut that same shape as many times.
Yeah.
So then if it's music, because the music is it's like drawing, it's very immediate to an effective.
Yes.
Then I'm carried away by being like frustrated and bored and the energy is not right. So then if it's like a story or a lecture, then I'm really distracted by the thing and I can make these repetitive things and sort of zone out.
Yeah. That's really cool. Well, we should tell people again how they can come and see your work.
Right. So First Friday is happening this Friday at Terrain Gallery on 628 North Monroe Street. First Friday is happening from 5 p.m. I believe they close at 8. I'm not, And then otherwise it's the regular gallery operating hours. It'll be open till the end of August.
Okay, and how do people go like, I don't know if I'll make it down there, but I really would like to see her work. Where would they find your work?
Sure. I have a website, jennifersehaw.com, JenniferSeo.com. My Instagram is also possible, I guess, SEO.JENN.
Okay, and I'll try to put that down in my show notes so people want to go and look at KYRS out and about, that you should be able to get that information there too. Jennifer, it was so lovely to meet you and to be with you and to hear about your work, and you've inspired me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. You've been a great host.
Okay, thanks. Okay, you have been listening to Out and About. And you are now listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane.
This is KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, heard at 88.1 and 92.3 on your FM dial, as well as worldwide on the internet at kyrs.org.
KYRS, Medical Lake, and K222BG, Dartford, 88.1 FM, 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio.
The following program was pre-recorded.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And all I know is that Todd Blanche is great. He's going to do a great job. Everybody knows it. And I understand there's been a sign-off, but I don't know what they agreed on.
Todd Blanche, the former personal attorney of President Trump, is one step closer to becoming attorney general. After two Republican senator holdouts said they were satisfied by a written order from Blanche issued Sunday that purports to rescind the $1.8 billion so-called anti-weaponization fund, what others call a slush fund, created as part of a controversial settlement deal between Trump and the IRS. The part of that deal granting Trump, his children, and his businesses immunity from retroactive tax audits remains intact. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney Gene Pirro dropped the criminal charges against former Olympian Davy Hearn over alleged vandalism of the reflecting pool, saying instead the damage was from a rushed and flawed renovation. We'll speak to attorney Norm Eisen. Then Emmett Till would have turned 85 on July 25th.
What if Emmett Till lived? What if he had returned home still a child, alive and free? What would that life have required of us all? These questions invite a reckoning with the past and a probing investigation of the current state of American life.
If Emmett Till Lived, that's the title of a new book and photography exhibit opening next month in Chicago. We'll be joined by cultural historian Sarah Elizabeth Lewis to talk about her collaboration with Emmett Till's cousin, the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. He was with Till almost until his lynching. And finally, the life and legacy of radical history.